Live from New York, it's the Gary Nall Show. And now, your host, Gary Nall.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about how doing good deeds helps socially anxious people relax, and how repeated courses of antibiotics may profoundly alter your gut, and how one in four people prescribed opiates progress to longer-term prescriptions, and how not having enough selenium is linked with an increased death of over 6.8 years. Wow. And a lot more on health and healing. Also, a special report today from Laura Miller. Addiction is not a disease. A neuroscientist argues that it's time to change our minds on the roots of substance abuse. A psychologist and former addict insists that the illness model for addiction is wrong and dangerously so. I would concur. That is why I've taken issue with the 12-step program and the addiction programs offered around the United States. Also, today you're going to hear something you have not heard before, read anywhere. We're going to give you one more piece of the puzzle on vaccines. And that is that when they say that the vaccine for polio eradicated polio, wasn't the case. Sean Siegel, VacTruth, the CDC made two radical changes and suddenly 30,000 diagnoses of polio instantly disappeared per year. I will report on this on today's show, how it was just a matter of semantics and how they recast these paralytic conditions as other conditions. Also today, I had thought this would happen. Now there's more confirmation from Jonathan Bentz, Natural News, that waves of homeschooling are sweeping California. Why? Because educated, concerned, conscientious parents know that they don't want to expose their children to the poisons and vaccines to stay in the public school system. So, right now, there's a movement either out of the state, as some parents are doing, or to homeschooling. Also today, I'm going to have a guest in the second part, Professor Michael Hudson, and we're going to take a different look at the Greek vote against the Eurozone and austerity measures and what the likely future will be. Why is this important? Well, today's New York Post headlines, Greek tragedy, national commits economic suicide. Think of how many people going to work this morning will read this and believe that it was all bad. I don't believe so. I believe it was exactly what the Greek population needed to do. Now let's see if they can go back to their own currency. And then waiting in the wings to see how this works out, Italy, Spain, Portugal, Ireland, and possibly France. Also, I was listening to a very interesting, very short, about 3.5 minute discussion about the earth and life, all life, including human life, and what we really are. Just molecules put together. And this is by a highly respected scientist. Okay, that's one perspective, and it's the most commonly held perspective. But today I'm going to share two others that will give a moment of pause and allow us to think, are we more than molecules? I firmly believe we are, and I'll share that perspective on today's program. Let's begin. I was asked last night, while I was getting a late night juice about, and by the way, the subtext to that conversation, person was asking about creating something that could help slow down the aging process. And in this discussion, I just returned from a film, a documentary on a pop star in England, Amy Winehouse. She was very successful from 2004, 2005, and 2006 actually it was 2005 up through 2011, and won a lot of awards, made a lot of money, and then ended up drinking herself to death. I didn't care for it as a documentary how it was made, because the real question was not answered. Who was responsible behind the scenes? Why didn't her father, mother, friends, no one interjected to stop this? In any case, it showed how narrow and tiny her world was. But it's true for most people. And there was a teenage daughter to the person I'm answering the question, and I said, we just celebrated the 4th of July. Which country did we seek our independence from? 16-year-old daughter did not know. And I asked several other questions that were anyone taking a basic civic or history class should have known, didn't know. Yet the pop culture, they're very up on. And it was just one of those glaring moments where someone who's straight-A student, top of her class, and is already seeking out Ivy League colleges, doesn't even know why we celebrate Independence Day. In any case, that's a separate issue. So I mentioned AMPK. Here's what it is, why it's important. It's an enzyme that serves as the body's master regulating switch, which means it inhibits multiple degenerative factors by revitalizing aging cells. Now, it's found in every cell, and it promotes longevity factors that have been shown to extend lifespan in numerous organisms. It increases the signaling that turns off many damaging effects of aging, thus enabling cells to return to their useful vitality. And the research is substantial. And so if you want to have a longer life, then AMPK should be a part of it. Now, the A stands for adenosine, and the M stands for monophosphate and activated protein kinase. So it's adenosine, monophosphate, activated protein kinase. And this activation has been shown to help target damaging factors of aging and increase supports to reduce fat storage, to create new mitochondria, and promote healthy blood glucose levels, so diabetics, pre-diabetics, overweight people would really benefit. And also in Asia, there was an extract of a plant that was traditionally used to promote longevity, and scientists know why. This G. pentaphalum, that's P-E-N-T-A-P-H-A-L-Y-L-L-U-M, promotes AMPK activation. And in one of many studies showing a wide variety of benefits, researchers documented a 1-inch reduction in abnormal circumference in overweight individuals who took 450 milligrams a day of this. So that's one of the things I was mentioning. And you also have grapes, grape seeds, grape skin, resveratrol. Those are all anti-aging, which is one of the reasons people who eat a lot of grapes or drink organic red wine or drink grape juice can have a longer life. And then, of course, the superstar of superstars is L-carnosine, and 1,000, 2,000 milligrams a day also helps. Then we're taking a look at how many people are on opiates. Right now I'm helping a person get off an opiate, and this was for pain. And a lot of people are taking opiates to reduce pain. This is from the Mayo Clinic. This is published in the Mayo Clinic Proceedings, a major journal. Quote, opiate painkiller addiction and accidental overdoses have become far too common in the United States. To try to identify who is at most risk, Mayo Clinic researchers studied how many patients prescribed an opiate painkiller for the first time progressed to long-term use. The answer, 1 in every 4 people. Wow. Quote, from the patient perspective, it's important to recognize the potential risk associated with these medications. I encourage use of alternative methods to manage pain, including non-opiate analgesics or other non-medication approaches. That reduces or even eliminates the risk of these medications transitioning to another form that was never intended, end quote. So what we have in the United States is we have people who have injuries or have different forms of causes of their pain. Frequently it's inflammatory responses. They end up with arthritis. Having a meat-based diet instead of a plant-based diet can cause a larger amount of arachidonic acid, and that can cause swelling in the feet, the fingers, the ankles, the knees, and pain. So people start taking these, and then at a certain point they don't work. So you have to take more powerful ones. And then you start taking the prescription ones. And the side effects are deadly to your kidneys, your liver, and your heart. Whereas if we simply went on a alkalizing, cleansing, substantially raw food, heavy juice diet, in about 3 weeks, you've substantially changed your biochemistry, turned off the pain. Now, there are also other things you can use. If it's physical and not just biochemical, you can use acupressure points for gentle massage and trigger therapy that can release muscles that are in spasm and help the knotting and tendons to release the knot and allow energy to flow again. Trigger point therapists are the specialization that does that. So there's no reason that we can't get people off these pain medications. And also cat's claw, cayenne high heat units, cabbage juice. These are all good at turning off pain. Now, when we're taking antibiotics, we disrupt the normal good bacteria in our body. That in turn can affect our immune system, and that means we're more susceptible to disease. This is from New York University School of Medicine, published in the peer-reviewed Nature Communications. Quote, a new animal study at New York University Langone Medical Center, researchers add to growing evidence that multiple courses of commonly used antibiotics may have a significant impact on children's development. And then it goes in to talk about how the antibiotics destroy the good bacteria and allow proliferation of the bad, and how that then ends up, quote, having long-lasting effects after several courses of antibiotics. Now you give a kid vaccines, then you start seeing inner ear infections and autoimmune conditions, so then you give them antibiotics, and that causes a loop where now the kid has even more immune-related problems. So you give them more antibiotics, now they have more immune-related problems. You would think someone in that system would stop for a moment and say, shouldn't we slow down and take a look at what's not working? The antibiotics are not working. So if that's the case, you can do two things. A, you can use natural chelating agents to try to trap and eliminate many of the heavy metals and toxins from the vaccine. That's doable. You can detoxify from vaccine. You then have to rebuild the mitochondria in the gut, the bacteria in the gut, and then the brain as well. And that's where you get yourself in the hands of a competent nutritionist or physician specializing in repair of the gut. And there's a whole series of processes you have to use. You have to turn off inflammation. You have to see if there's leaky gut. You have to see what kind of bacteria or yeast are growing there. You have to get them on a sugar-free, acid, really, you can't be an acid-free, but low acid and high alkaline input food. And then probiotics and glutamine at 3 to 5,000 milligrams really helps repair the damage to your intestine. Cabbage juice, 2 glasses a day, raw organic cabbage juice can help you with ulcers, Helicobacter E. pylori bacterium that can lead to cancer and inflammation. It can help rebalance your intestine, turn off inflammation. R-alpha-lipoic acid, 500 milligrams twice a day also helps. Quercetin helps. And then Manuka honey in chamomile with 10 drops of marshmallow root is very good as well. And then a methylated B12 and methylated folic acid do a great deal of good, as well as D-ribose and the very important thing that's missing in a lot of kids with autism, but also a lot of adults, is a branched-chain amino acids. A study links nuts to lower body weight and a risk of obesity from Louisiana State University, published in the journal Nutrition. Quote, researchers compared risk factors for heart disease and metabolic syndrome, there's your diabetes, of tree nuts consumers versus those who did not consume tree nuts. Tree nuts, by the way, for this audience, you know, there are almonds, Brazil nuts, cashews, hazelnuts, macadamias, pecans, pine nuts, pistachios, and walnuts. And consumption, quote, was associated with a lower body mass index, meaning less fat and lower systolic blood pressure. That's good. Higher insulin activity. That's good. And higher levels of high-density lipoprotein cholesterol, the good cholesterol. That's good. In addition, the tree nuts were 25% less likely to be obese and 21% less likely to have an elevated waist circumference than those that did not consume the nuts. They studied 14,000 men and women 19 years and older for 5 years in the National Health Nutrition Examination Survey. So, eat the organic, not cooked, not deep fried and salted. Eat the raw nuts or nut butters. It's really, really good for you. And finally, from Simon Fraser University in Canada, published in Motivation and Emotion, doing good deeds helps socially anxious people relax. Quote, being busy with acts of kindness can help people who suffer from social anxiety to mingle more easily. And that's based upon what they found in this research. And we know that sufferers from social anxiety are more than just a little shy. Dealing with others might make them feel so threatened or anxious that they often actively avoid socializing. And so just start looking at all the things you could do good. I would suggest if you have any form of anxiety, one act of kindness can be going to soup kitchens and just helping. They always need help. Volunteer your time, and everything you do, whether it's helping prepare the food or helping serve the food, you're looking at another human being that sure does need a hand. And I believe that if we have a gift in life, no matter what that gift is, we have a moral and spiritual responsibility to share it without thinking, what's it worth? What can I get in return? The gifts of life should not be commodified and commercialized. And I wish more people would appreciate that. We've gotten to a point where the only values we have in life are those that can be commodified. So acts of kindness helps us relax. And for people that are relaxed, well, it's just extra good for you. Now to something that I feel needs to be addressed. It's short, but it's relevant. I'm going to quote a brief piece in Salon from Laura Miller, PhD, quote, the mystery of addiction, what it is, what causes it, and how to end it, threads through most of our lives. Experts estimate that 1 in 10 Americans depend upon alcohol and other drugs, and if we concede that behaviors like gambling, overeating, and playing video games can be addictive in similar ways, it's likely that everyone has a relative or friend who's hooked on some form of fun to a destructive degree. But what exactly is wrong with them? For several decades now, it's been a commonplace to say that addicts have a disease. However, the very same scientists who once seemed to back up that claim have begun to tear it down. Once, addictions were viewed as failures of character and morals, and society responded to drunks and junkies with shaming, scolding, and calls for more willpower. This provided spectacularly ineffective, although, truth be told, most addicts do quit without any form of treatment. Nevertheless, many do not, and in the mid-20th century, the recovery movement centered around the 12-step method developed by the founders of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it became a godsend for those unable to quit drinking or drugging on their own. The approach spread to so-called behavioral addictions like gambling or sex. Activities that don't even involve the ingestion of any kind of mind-altering substance. Much of the potency of AA comes from its acknowledgement that willpower isn't enough to beat this devil, and that blame rather than whipping the blamed person into shape is counterproductive. The first step requires admitting one's helplessness in the face of an addiction, taking recovery out of the arena of simple self-control and into a realm of transcendence. We're powerless over the addictive substance and trust in a higher power. In the program itself, to provide us with the strength and strategy to quit. But an important principle of the 12-step is that addiction is chronic and likely congenital. You can be sober indefinitely, but you'll never be cured. You always remain an addict, even if you never use again. Well, the flourishing of the 12-step movement is one of the reasons why we now routinely describe addiction as a disease. Why? Because to have a disease instead of, say, a dangerous habit is to be powerless to do anything except apply the prescribed cure. A person with a disease is unfortunate rather than foolish or weak or degenerate. Something innate in your body has gone wrong, particularly in your brain, and it's made you exceptionally susceptible to getting hooked. You always have and always will contain a bomb. The important question is, can you go the next 24 hours without setting a match to it? Another factor promoting the disease model is that it has ushered addiction under the control of healthcare industry, whether in the form of an illness whose treatment can be charged to an insurance company or as the focus of a profit-making rehab center. Well, this conception of addiction as a biological phenomenon seen to be endorsed over the last 20 years as a new technology allowed neuroscientists to measure the human brain and its activities in ever more detail. But neuroscientists giveth and now neuroscience taketh away. The recovery movement rehab industry, two separate things, although the latter often employs the techniques of the former, have always had their critics. But lately, some of the most vocal critics have been the neuroscientists whose findings once lent them credibility. One of those neuroscientists is Mark Lewis, a psychologist and former addict himself, also the author of a new book, The Biology of Desire, Why Addiction is Not a Disease. Lewis's argument is actually fairly simple. The disease theory and the science sometimes used to support it fail to take into account the way the brain actually operates. Of course, the brain changes with addiction, he writes, but the way it changes has to do with learning and development, not disease. All significant and repeated experiences change the brain. Adaptability and habit are the brain's secret weapons. The changes wrought by addiction are not, however, permanent, and while they are dangerous, they're not abnormal. And through a combination of a difficult emotional history, bad luck, and ordinary operations of the brain itself, an addict is someone whose brain has been transformed, but also someone who can be pushed further along the road towards healthy development. Now, my thoughts on this. Because it was a time in my life where I worked with addicts every single day at the Trafalgar Hospital, where they were one of the city's largest centers for helping addicts, and they primarily used methadone. I introduced a holistic therapy, and the holistic therapy was to detoxify the person's body, but more importantly, I'd detoxify the mind, and I never suggested that it was a disease. In fact, they would always say, well, I have a disease. I said, show me the disease. Well, you know, it's in my brain. All right, let's take a look, an MRI of your brain. It's no different than someone who hasn't. Now, if you start taking drugs, you can change the chemistry of your brain. If you take medication, you can change the chemistry of your brain. So if you take an addict before, a person who describes himself as an addict, before they have, taken anything, and then you take the addict's brain MRI images, you know, 6 months after they've been on a substance, alcohol or anything else, you'll see a difference. But it's due to what they're doing, not because they have an abnormal brain. And so I said, what if you rewrote your story, and what lessons could you learn if you simply say, at a point in my life, due to some things I was conscious of and some things I was not, epigenetically unaware of, I made choices. Those didn't end up being the right choice. I made some wrong choices. By going back and living my life in reverse and being non-judgmental, simply looking at it for what it is, I can now see, here are the choices I made at that time, and here's the probable reason I made them, and here's who was affected, here's how I continued to stay in that mindset, because every time you do something, every time you drink, every time you do a drug, you are, in effect, conditioning the mind for that. You're reconditioning the brain, and that's what this former addict says in his new book, and he is correct on that. But what if you have an interdiction? And here's the key. I believe in our society we do not have enough people willing to step forward or can, who have either the skill or the compassion to support us in our recovery efforts. It's one thing helping a person get through the physical withdrawal. That in itself is a challenge. It's something else to be patient and non-judgmental as a person begins to look at this massive puzzle with hundreds of millions of pieces of the puzzle that they have to put back together to see what were the circumstances underlying the behavior they made. To call that a disease is to do disservice to all the people who are victims, including the perpetrator, who is also the ultimate victim. And with more humanistic sciences of helping people and having support systems that help people, there'll be a lot more people who won't be going back, nor think, well, I got to get through the next 24 hours. I'm under a lot of pressure. If I don't go to 6 meetings today, I've literally seen people leave work to go 6 times a day to these meetings, or I'm going to explode. Well, then that meeting isn't really helping you. Because when you come back to work, you reset the time clock, and now you put yourself under this artificial perception. But what you think you believe, you will. Interesting, I had someone years ago, this is 1990, and working on a ranch down there next to mine, and I heard this guy yelling, went out there, and he was grabbing his leg. I said, what's wrong? He said, I've been bit by this deadly scorpion. So I looked at the scorpion, and I said, this is not a poisonous scorpion. There are no poisonous scorpions in this area. Yeah, and yes, it is. And I said, no. I said, but here's some things you can do. And the guy went to the hospital. And sure enough, in the hospital, the leg was all swollen. And the nurse said, well, this is not a poisonous scorpion. You're not poisoned. He said, I'm not poisoned. Said, you're not poisoned. Swelling went right down. Person was fine. Blood pressure came down. Everything came down. That's one tiny example of how powerful our perceptions are. So if you believe you're an addict, even if you're going to work all day today not to engage in that, imagine the power that has over the rest of your life. So this idea that we've made all the addicts diseases so that they can be commodified and commercialized through the medical system and the pharmaceutical system and the hospital system and the recovery system does such a disservice. In any case, I appreciate that finally someone has taken this on and written a book on it. I'll see about having him on the program. I'm Gary Noll. We're going to take a break. Come back in a moment. Please stay with us. In about 7 minutes now, we're going to have Professor Michael Hudson on, but right now we're going to take 3 minutes and listen to what is human existence. It turns out it's pretty simple. We're told we're dead stars looking back at the sky.
So what is human existence? How can you actually sum it up? It turns out it's really pretty simple. We are dead stars looking back up at the sky. Everything you are, I mean, literally the iron in your blood comes from the instant before a star dies. You know, you cut yourself and you see that red from that oxygenated hemoglobin. And that was the instant of a death of a solar system. The universe began with only the element hydrogen, the very, very simplest atom that exists. And the only thing in the universe that can make a bigger atom is a star. The entire periodic table, every element you've ever heard of, was processed inside the body of a star, and that star then unraveled or exploded, and here we are. All a star is a dust cloud that is collapsing under the force of gravity. That's it. And when you compress gas together, it actually heats up. There's a time when that's hot enough to set off a nuclear fusion reaction. And that actually supports the star. This nuclear explosion inside supports the star against further collapse. But that nuclear fusion reaction is using fuel. It's using hydrogen. And so eventually that will burn out and the collapse of gravity will keep going. In the case of a more massive star, the gravity crushes ever more and more tightly. Things get hotter inside. You create things like carbon and oxygen and nitrogen. Until finally you get to the element iron. It fuses iron together, and instead of energy coming out, energy is actually absorbed, and the core of the star collapses. And that sets off the most violent, brilliant reaction we know of, called a supernova reaction. Everything outside the element of iron, everything heavier, all the gold, all the silver, all of the lead, all the uranium, that's formed in that supernova explosion. A single star will glow as brightly as an entire galaxy, as hundreds of billions of stars in that moment of death. And that's what you are. That is literally what your body is that instant of death. You know, it is so tempting. I mean, humans have done this for literally tens of thousands of years, to think of the stars as eternal. The stars will all burn out someday. There's only a certain amount of stellar fuel, of hydrogen. The stars are burning through it. And then the stars, as we know them, will all die out in some trillions of years. And the universe will be dark for the rest of time, whatever that means. But think about that. We're actually living in Eden right now. We're living in a time when this, you know, 10 billion year lived thing, the sun, is pouring down free energy. We are using it. We are evolving. We are becoming sentient. We are looking out at the universe. And what an amazing thing to think that that's only for a tiny little brief part of the universe's history. And everything else will be dark. It does give you an ownership about how, you know, how wonderful this time is, how wonderful your life is right now, your literal life, but also how wonderful this time in the universe is. And someday I wonder if people will have myths about, you know, the days when stars rain down free sunlight and free energy.
That's one perspective. In effect, we're just atoms. That if you took the iron from Alaska, or the gold that comes into the ground in Sierra Leone, and the phosphorus from Minnesota, it's all the same. And we're merely combinations of these minerals, these heavy minerals, micronutrients put together, and we have this energy. And like the star that died, we die. That's certainly a common and respected perspective. After my guest, I will share a different perspective. So please stay tuned for that. But now let's go over to say hello to Dr. Michael Hudson. He is one of our nation's important economists and Wall Street analysts. He is currently the president of the Institute for Study of Long-Term Economic Trends and was the chief economic policy advisor for Representative Dennis Kucinich. And he is the author of The Bubble and Beyond, Fictitious Capital, Debt Deflation and Global Crisis, as well as Financial Capitalism and Its Discontents. His website is michael-hudson.com. Nice to have you with us today.
Good to be here.
Two things before you address these. Today's front page of most newspapers. I scanned almost all the major newspapers, but I'll just use the New York Post as an example. Greek tragedy. Nation commits economic suicide. All right? So that's, and by the way, that is most. They're all saying, well, yeah, they had to do something, but it was a giant mistake. We're given the idea that everyone in Greece who voted no is foolish because now they will go into a deep hurt, a deep pain. They cannot survive without the Eurozone and the Euro. And what they should do is, all right, the best case scenario now, and this was on MSNBC and others this morning, is go in and try to negotiate a little bit of a discount on your $274 billion debt. And that's what they're suggesting, all right? Now, that's one. I'm going to play now a short little minute, 20-second clip from Channel 4, Paul Mason from Athens this morning.
So the news is, it looks like no has won the Greek referendum by about 60%. Let me just put that into context. Here's who was backing yes. Angela Merkel, the European Commission, the socialists in the European Parliament and their leader Martin Schulz, every political party here except the far-left party, Syriza, and its right-wing ally, Anel, the whole political establishment, every private TV station, and to quote a famous football commentator, all of the people I've just mentioned have just taken a hell of a beating. Because it's not just that left-wing one-third of Greek society whose granddads fought in the Civil War and beat the Nazis and tore down the swastika from the Acropolis behind me. It's not just them. Who's voted no to the European proposal is conservatives and liberal voters. Even the heartland of the former Prime Minister Antonis Samaras, it appears, has voted no. So something has to happen. All those European leaders who told Greece that if they voted no, they would be kicked out of the euro are probably not going to be making good on that promise today, because they may feel like it. They may feel that Greece and its model and its people no longer really have a place inside the eurozone. But what they will be doing if they did that is to kick out the liberals and conservatives and the new Labour types of Greece from Europe. That would be what they would be doing. They are, I would imagine tonight, in something of disarray. But there's an easy answer. They have to turn the banks back on by reinstating emergency lending assistance. They have to start talking to Alexis Tsipras, whose ministers right now will be heading for the airport to go to Brussels. And they have to probably understand that for the first time in the history of the Eurozone, people power has happened.
People power happened. Michael, here's what the average American is not aware of, and I'm not sure that many of the people living in the Eurozone countries are aware of it. In the past 5 years, the Greek has gone through everything that it's been told to go through. They have reduced a 15% deficit to zero. They've had an economy, because people aren't working and don't have money, that's contracted by 25%. Incomes have fallen by over a third across the country. Pensions, which is the only money many people have to live on, were cut by 40%. 18,000 people, as of last night, were homeless, sleeping in the streets of Athens alone. And the highest number of suicides in the country's history because of financial worries. And the church is now having to raise tens of thousands of children in orphanages. And almost 40% of the entire population live under the poverty line. So it's not as if they haven't tried to do something to acknowledge, well, we have this debt, but no one is saying how much of that $270 more or less billion dollars did they actually receive? How much of this is about financial institutions and investors manipulating the monies and the debt for their own advantage? Could you take us through a layman's understanding of what has led up to this and what the Greeks hopefully will do to have a future?
Well, first of all, you're right to point out the suicide. It's amazing that the Pope would say Greece is committing suicide, because suicide rates have been rising along with unemployment, and Greece has lost about 10% of its population in the last few years, mainly working age population. I just got back from Greece, where I was working with the Syriza Party, and then I went to Brussels to address Parliament there on how to get out of this situation. The problem really began in 2010 and 11. Goldman Sachs an American firm, had worked with a Lucas Papademos, a central banker in charge of Greece Central Bank, to make it appear as if Greece's debt was much smaller than it was. And they did this by doing a derivatives trade that made millions of dollars for Goldman Sachs. So as a result of the euro, huge amounts of loans were made to the Greek oligarchy. These are the richest 1%. When people say the Greeks ran up debt, what they mean is a bunch of crooks that are as crooked in Greece as the Russian kleptocrats. The military regime, you may remember the movie Z, the military regime that NATO and the U.S. put in, whose job was to assassinate most of the socialist leaders, put in power just a group of tax avoiders and others. Well, finally, in 2010, when Papandreou won on the socialist ticket, he said, look, here's the real fact of how much we owe. We owe about 45 billion euros, and we also find out that the IMF official, Christine Lagarde, sent a list of Greek tax avoiders who had 50 billion euros just in Switzerland alone. So basically, Greece said, look, the amount of debt that we have to pay, we can't. We'd like to pay. There's no money to pay. So there has to be a debt write-down. The International Monetary Fund, which is always run by a Frenchman by practice, and at that time was written by the sex party man, Dominique Strauss-Kahn, the IMF analyst said, look, Greece cannot pay the debts. They're fictitious debts. We need to the bondholders to take a loss of about $100 billion. The European Central Bank said, wait a minute. If you say that Greece can't pay the debts, then we say, let them just lower wages. Let them cut wages in half. Half the population can move out of the country. And if you don't say this, IMF, we won't let you be part of it. Well, then Dominique Strauss-Kahn wanted to run as president of France, and French banks were the largest holders of the Greek debt. So Strauss-Kahn overruled the IMF and said, we're going to lend the Greek government the money to pay French bondholders and German bondholders. Not a penny will go to Greece, but we have to bail out. And there was still a little argument. You know, there was, the heads of the IMF's European economic team resigned and went to the press and said the IMF is, falsifying the data. The board disagreed. And matters got much worse in 2010 when Obama and Geithner went to the G8 meetings with Angela Merkel of Germany and the French, and told the Greeks, look, American banks have made huge bets, derivative bets, that the Greeks will pay. If the Greeks default and don't pay the unpayable debts, then American banks have bet so much money on this horse race that they're all going to go broke. You have to, European Central Bank and IMF, have to lend them enough money to pay the bondholders. So all this gigantic debt that the Greeks owe was not used by Greeks. It was used to pay Obama's campaign contributors and the French banks and the German banks. And the price was that they've increased unemployment to 50% of youth under 30. And it was basically the youth who came in and began voting after about 3 o'clock in the afternoon yesterday that swung the whole tide against succumbing to Europe. There's a myth that somehow Greece has to leave the euro or the eurozone. That was spread by the European Central Bank that said, I, the head of the European Central Bank, Jean-Claude Juncker, will kick you out of Europe. But there's no way that anyone can, that a bureaucrat who's a bank lobbyist, who's put in specifically, you know, by the anti-labor group, one unelected bureaucrat can't kick any country out of Europe. Greece is not going to be kicked out of Europe by not paying the IMF. When I met there 2 weeks ago, the Syriza Parliamentary Committee had just published what they called the debt Truth Commission. And they found that most of this debt was fictitious and what they call legally odious. They are not, they've decided not to pay a penny to the IMF, not to pay a penny to the European Central Bank, that this money was fictitiously created just electronically to take all of the private debts, pay the bondholders, so that they made a killing. People, investors, insiders of the Obama administration on Wall Street made billions of dollars because the market had priced Greek debt at about 33%, 20%, hardly anything. And all of a sudden, the bonds were all paid off at their full face value. So it made fortunes for speculators. And now the Greeks are saying, well, you have to lower your incomes by enough to pay all of these debts. The equilibrium price of labor will be wages must be cut by 80%, and 70% of the Greeks have to emigrate very quickly, including almost everybody under 40. This is the death trap that they all realized, and it took the last 6 months have been used basically by Tsipras, the head of Greece, and Yanis Varoufakis, explaining to the Greeks just, you know, the kind of mess that the bankers have put them in. And the American press and the European press didn't want to believe it. If you read the press all last week, they said, oh, there's going to be a yes vote. It's going to be overwhelming. Finally, the government's going to fall. And they were just writing what they hoped would happen. There was no attempt at all to gauge the reality on the ground. And I could see in Athens and in Delphi, the places I was, that the Greeks knew what was happening, and what they were going to do was say, look, we're not going to bail out the corrupt oligarchy that ran up the debts. If Europe wants to collect the money, let it go to the oligarchs' funds in Switzerland, all of the tax evasion, you know, let them get it from the oligarchs. But no country, in principle, no sovereign country, should be obliged to commit economic suicide, to sacrifice its economy, and to do what the central bank really wants. And the central bank said, you have to sell off your entire public domain. You have to sell off your islands to the Germans or other foreign investors. You have to sell off your gas rights, but not to the Russians. You have to sell them not to the highest bidder, but to the lowest bidder, if that's what we tell you, because the system of the Greek privatizations is as corrupt as it is in Russia. And the Greeks didn't want any part of it. They said, oh, my God, if the public domain, if the Parthenon is sold, if all these other things are sold off to pay the debts that crooks ran up, then we can't afford to live here anymore. And that's really what the election is about, and there has not been a word of that in the today's press release by the New York Times or other papers.
Michael, a very distinguished economist, Joseph Stiglitz, stated that according to an ATTAC Austria study, 77% of this big debt, we're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars, quote, provided for the so-called Greek bailout, went to the financial sector and not the people. I quote, went to the financial sector. So when we are hearing, oh, you know, they owe $366 billion, that's the highest I've heard less. That money, the Greek people didn't receive $366 billion. It was the oligarchs and the corrupt people you mentioned, but also it was the way that these banks play games by creating debt, and then that becomes what the country is responsible for. The World Bank's been doing that for a long time. So what are the options for the Greek people at this moment to go forward? What do you see the likely outcome to be since you've been speaking with them?
Well, there's a basic mathematical principle at work. Debts that can't be paid won't be. There's no money to pay the debts. Even if there was a party that were to come into power that wanted to pay, there's no money to pay. So there's no question the debts can't be paid. Apparently, quite a few American hedge funds, like Paulson's fund, bet tens of millions, maybe hundreds of millions of dollars that somehow the Greeks would pay. They've lost, and that's sort of shaken up Wall Street, but there can't be paid. Now, the question then is, what is Europe going to do about it? for Greece, none of this need be a problem at all, because as you just pointed out, the money that was created to lend to the bondholders, not even to the Greek financial sector, not to the Greek oligarchs, but to the French, German, and American bondholders, all this is created on a computer. When Greece says we won't pay the IMF or the European Central Bank, that doesn't mean that pension fund holders or investors are going to lose the money. It means that electronic credit is going to be canceled. So none of this need be a problem at all. It's a completely artificial problem created by the fact that the real aim of Europe is not to get Greece to repay the debts, but to use debt leverage to say, you can't pay, fine, begin selling off your natural resources and your public domain. And the Greeks are not going to sell it. They're not going to privatize. And they're going to try to have business as usual and tell Europe essentially, okay, we're not going to pay. What are you going to do about it? And I don't know what Europe can do about it, except maybe push a coup d'etat. As long as Greece doesn't, I think the Americans went over, State Department officials went over there recently and said, well, as long as you don't play games with Russia and try to withdraw from NATO, then, you know, do pretty much whatever you want. But it was the Americans that pushed in the military dictatorship originally a few decades ago. So the Greeks are a little worried about what foreign countries will do. But the idea now is that, the European Central Bank tried to frighten the Greeks last week by saying, we will create chaos. If you try to withdraw, we're going to not give the banks any notes to print out. We're going to wreck the banks. Well, the Greek Syriza response is, aha, the banks are how the oligarchs have been running the country all along. If you want to collapse the banks, that's fine. Then we'll take them over. We'll use them as a public option. We'll offer banking services at low credit card rates. We'll pay depositors. We're not going to make corrupt takeover loans. We're not going to do money laundering like the banks do. You want to wreck the banks? The fact is you can empty them out of money, but they're still there. We'll take over. We're going to print either our drachmas or we'll print our own scrip, just like Jerry Brown did in California. Very simple. They're going to get by one way or another, and the Greeks had enough faith in the government that they voted into office democratically that they think, well, do what you want. We're going to get by.
Last, I need a short answer for this. Isn't it rather hypocritical that the very financial institutions like Goldman Sachs and Bank of America, others, the Deutsche Bank, that were virtually dead at the beginning of the financial crisis and received huge infusions from the Federal Reserve, all told between 16 to 21 trillion, depending upon Ron Paul and Bernie Sanders' audit figures, and got at zero interest, 0.2%, 0.25%, which is zero interest, and got to relieve themselves of their toxic assets, they got a start over. We don't give any student loan start overs. That would only be $1.2 trillion. And now that Greece is asking, you know, forgive all this debt. Let's start from scratch. We're saying no. And yet that's exactly what they did in the banking community and Wall Street community here in the United States.
That's because the banks here are the largest campaign contributors to both political parties, and they get to name and nominate, or at least block, any Federal Reserve official or Treasury official that they don't think is on their side. So what really is at stake is, what kind of a world are we going to have? Are we going to have a world that's run by the financial interests in a predatory, extractive way, or are we going to run a world based on how the real economy works and for the 99% instead of the 1%. It's really, finance is the new form of warfare. It's the new way of acquiring land or raw materials or monopolies. And the Greeks realize that they're at war. And in a war, you have a right to defend yourself against the aggressor, and the demand for debt repayment by privatizing their economy is an act of financial war, and they're finally realized that there is a war going on, and they're fighting back. And I think they realize it more than America realizes that there's also a financial war here, and as Warren Buffett said, we the 1% are winning.
Michael Hudson, we look forward to another conversation, especially about the derivative bubble in the United States and how it could be one of the most single lethal situations for the future of our economy, and we'll invite you back to discuss that. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Gary.
Dr. Michael Hudson travels the world and consults with the Chinese government and the Icelandic government and, last week, the Greek government. So you're hearing from one of the policymakers who helps the countries to challenge the oligarchy, and we appreciate him sharing his insights. I'll continue tomorrow and give you the other side of that equation of what we are made of and what is the purpose of life. We can save that till 24 hours from now. Thank you all for listening. I'm Gary Knoll. Have a nice day. Change, change, change.